Well, hi again. This is Bob Brundage, and today is June the 4th, 2009. And today I'm having the pleasure of talking with Glenn Morningstar back in Michigan. And we're looking forward to an interesting conversation about his career and also a little bit about Lovett Hall and the Henry Ford Museum and so forth. So, Glenn, welcome to my little project, and I'm honored to have you with us, and I hope you'll tell us a little bit about where you're born and brought up, and you take it from here.
Well, okay, Bob, thanks very much for asking. My pleasure to chat with you. I grew up, I was born in Saginaw, Michigan, Saginaw County, up in the in bean country and sugar beet country, and was a farm kid. My parents had met at a Grange dance. The between the two of them belonged to three different Granges in Saginaw area. Forest Grange was in Thomas Township up in Saginaw County, and Locust Grange was also in Saginaw County out to, I think, still Thomas Township. And then Spalding Grange was in Spalding Township. But I say that only because my parents danced a lot.
Yeah.
They were not musicians, although my mother's family was. My mother's brothers were musicians. But they met at a Grange dance. Their parents were dancers at the Grange dances. My mom's parents' family's name was Kreller, and of course my family's name was Morningstar, and they hit the circuit. They went to the different Grange dances, also the Golden Globe Ballroom, a couple of other places that were in the general Thomas Township, Richland Township area in Saginaw County. So I was born there, grew up as a Grange kid, a farm kid, and my sister and I were very close. We were born a year apart, and when my folks traveled to these dances, why, we traveled with them, and it was the common story of the kids of the day that sometime between when the dance started and the dance ended, you'd find yourself in a pile of coats on the benches in the corner. Everybody put their kids there, and we'd all be sleeping in heaps, you know, in the corner,
right.
And then we'd go home from there. So I was exposed to dancing and live music early on.
Yes.
And they were doing primarily couple dances and square dances at that time. And
visiting couple, probably?
Yeah, two-step, foxtrot, waltz, polka, shottish. In fact, my dad was, him and my aunt, my mother's brother's wife, polka'd quite a bit together, and they won a number of awards up in Bay City as polka as the polka contestants. So I got a big kick out of that. So grew up as a farm kid, and was a student at St. Peter's Lutheran School, which was part of St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Richland Township. Went to school there through the eighth grade. And it was at that school that the recreation, or one of the recreation activities, was square dancing. And it was led by Lawrence Lazel, a good old German name. It was a German Lutheran community.
Uh-huh.
And he led the square dancing, taught us, and then he used the Decca records, which he, years later, passed along to me. So I have his collection.
Good.
And so that was our recreation, and as part of that, the parents supported the kids going to different schools and exchanges where, I know, Buena Vista and Breckenridge schools would come to St. Pete's, and we'd go to their schools, and we'd put on demonstrations of our square dances.
I see.
And the one I remember that we did, and our demonstration was Star Route. And the reason I remember it a bit is because in Power Square, I was the caller, the prompter. So as the music was playing, I was giving brief calls every once in a while to remind us all about that. And that was third grade, I'm pretty sure. It might have been fourth or fifth, but I think it was third grade. In fact, my mother made the outfits for our square, and I've got a photo of the shirts that she made the fellas, red and white checkered with longhorn steers on the front, and she was very creative in her sewing. So that's how we were connected to the square dancing in Saginaw County, was through the activities through St. Peter's Lutheran School, and then, of course, the Grange dances that continued on for quite a while.
Yeah, well, that's how you got started calling then.
Yeah, that was the first time.
Right. Well, then your father wasn't a caller, was he?
No, my father wasn't a caller. He was just a good dancer.
Yeah, okay. then I think a little later on you married and moved to a different town. I've got down here that in my notes that something about the Pink Creek Folklore Society.
Yes. I went to General Motors Institute for college years and worked for General Motors starting in 1965, and then transferred down to Rochester. Well, transferred to Warren, Michigan, at the General Motors Tech Center in 1975, and my wife and I both moved down to Rochester as part of that. That's the town that's most notable for Leader Dogs for the Blind. That's where it started. And so while we were there in Rochester, we got connected with the Rochester Folk Workshop, which was owned and operated by Vincent Sadowski. And as part of that, a group that had just been started called the Paint Creek Folklore Society. And my wife Judy and I were both musicians as kids. She was accordion and piano, and I was piano and accordion and banjo primarily. And when we got to the Folklore Society, it was the perfect place for us, because one of the purposes of the Folklore Society was to teach each other how to play different instruments.
Yes.
And as well promoted dancing, and I became a part of that promotion through a sister organization called the Detroit Country Dance Society that had formed just a little bit after Paint Creek Folklore Society. And that was formed by Bert Schwartz and Paul Tyler. And Burton was the early Country Dance and Song Society area representative.
Okay.
And so people from Paint Creek Folklore Society were going to these dances that Bert and Paul had started up.
Yes.
And it was all with recorded music.
Uh-huh.
And we invited Bert to come to one of our picnics. I'm going to say it was 1977 or 78. I think it was 77. And lead dancing, and we provided the music for him from the Folklore Society, and he really enjoyed that. And so a number of us put on an effort to learn how to play the fiddle, because there weren't that many fiddlers in the area playing for dances.
Good.
And, so a fellow by the name of Al Smitley and I started playing fiddle, and my wife Judy and I and two other folks, Tom Radcliffe and Rosemary Kornacki, we were playing as a small group in the area, and Bert tapped us on the shoulder to play for a couple of his dances, and so we did. And that launched, that foursome launched into this big project through Paint Creek Folklore Society that generated the Old Michigan Roughwater String Band.
Okay.
And
as I remember, you wound up as a board of directors at the Folklore Society.
Yes, I was one of the early vice presidents with Tom Radcliffe. He was the president, and then shortly after that became one of the presidents, and then I was with the board of directors for Paint Creek for many, many years, and on occasion get back into a leadership role there, but in the 70s, 80s, and into the early 90s was on the board of directors the whole time. And that Folklore Society generated a lot of musicians because we were teaching each other how to play different instruments and traveling to festivals and dances.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, tell us a little more about this Old Michigan Roughwater String Band.
Well, Bob, the string band really grew out of the comment I made earlier about the need for dance musicians. And there were three groups that were playing occasionally for the dances at that point, and that was our group that was called Simple Gifts, one of the many Simple Gifts bands. Another group called Buffalo Nickel, and another group that was led by a husband and wife team, Rich and Maureen Del Grosso. And so we were all kind of hit and miss on some of the dances that Bert wanted to do. So I was privileged to put this idea on paper that says, why don't we have a collective? And so we sent the word out to the Folklore Society and to these three small groups who were members of the Folklore Society to say, why don't we form one big band? And then we can mix and match people as needed for the different requests for dance music in the area, because by then it was Bert that was calling, and there was dancing in Ann Arbor, dancing in Lansing as well, East Lansing.
Uh-huh.
So we pulled together this big band that had four dulcimers, three fiddlers, bass, mandolin, banjo, recorder, spoons, and baritone. So it was just a wonderful orchestra. We're still active today, as a matter of fact. And that was 1978.
Wow.
That pulled that orchestra together.
30 years ago, right?
Yeah. And we're very close to each other yet and still play. And we do a lot of things as band members playing music, but we also do a lot of things as band member and families. We have a getaway every year where we go to a place that'll hold us all, a bed and breakfast typically, that lets us kind of take over their place for a weekend, and we play music, and we go kayaking, and we go to see special events like fly-ins at the local airport, or dinner together at a special restaurant, and
right.
Things like that.
Well, so I assume you also play for dances broken up in smaller groups, probably.
We do, and typically we're anywhere from two to four pieces as we go out and play for, you know, community dances or church dances or dance weekends. Lovett Hall was our one place where there would be, you know, between 10 and 12 of us typically playing for the dances there on first Sundays, all dressed up in black and whites, you know. So.
Right, well... I understand you consider yourself a historian as well.
Well, I got interested in dance history really prompted by Bert Schwartz. He had been doing quite a bit of research, and he was calling English country dance, and he was calling squares, he was calling contras, and between Bert and some of the work of Paul Tyler, well, Bert in particular, it got us connected to Bria Christmas School, Bria Christmas Country Dance School, and he invited us to go down there, and once we got down there, we got connected with a whole bunch of callers and historians that really piqued my interest in the history of dance in Michigan and obviously in the United States as well. We enjoy doing Civil War balls and Revolutionary Period balls, and I do quite a number of things with schools that it's not unique. I know it's been done before, and it's called Dance Your Way Through American History. And the kids are just sponges as far as information goes, and they just really, third graders, fourth graders, fifth graders, really are keen on finding out more about history and having fun doing dances from the period that are fun to do.
Yes.
In fact, I just finished week before last. I had 1,000 eighth graders from the Troy school system, which is a town to the east of us here, and they had four different schools across 4 days, and 250 kids each day. So I had kids for a 45-minute segment, typically 40, 45 kids for each of six segments each day.
Right.
And, it was just a ton of fun. Eighth graders are a lot of fun. So that's a part of the history thing, those things that I'm able to do now. And obviously in the footsteps of the work that was done by Bert and other people that had done things from the bicentennial period.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I had down here a mention of Berea. You went to their Christmas school, was that it?
Yeah, we went for the first time, Bob, in 1979, and enjoyed it so much. And then in 1980, we thought we'd try another school, and we went down to the Appalachian Celebration, which was run by Glenn Fulbright down at Moorhead in Kentucky, at Moorhead State University. And then we came back to Christmas school in 1981, and were on staff, and Judy and I were on staff at Christmas school I forget for how long, but into the early 90s anyway. So for somewhere around 10 years we were on staff at Berea Christmas School. And John Ramsey, who was the director of Christmas school in the Berea,
yes, I met him, yes.
Oh, he's a grand fellow, and he just led us to so many open doors. If I was to point to one person that's made the biggest impact on us and our dance activities, it's probably John Ramsey, because of the doors he opened for us and opportunities he afforded to us.
Right.
Christmas school. Wonderful place.
Yes. Yeah, I visited there one time and really enjoyed myself, just as a visitor, not as a student. But
you could wear yourself to a frazzle.
Yeah, that's true. I understand you also have quite a substantial music library.
Yes, I do. Probably a third of it, anyway, is a collection of materials about Henry Ford and about Benjamin Lovett. Certainly all the Good Morning books and all four editions of those, and Ford's connection to Berea College down in Rome, Georgia, and Martha Berea, the work that she did down there, certainly with Henry Ford Museum in Greenfield Village, the Dearborn Independence that Henry provided articles to before he published the Good Morning books, a lot of dances and dance instruction there, quite a bit of the Lloyd Shaw Foundation materials. That was another great find, was Lloyd Shaw Foundation. And Gib Gilbert was the fellow that introduced us to the foundation. And then Lou and Enid Koch, and certainly Don Armstrong. Well, we had a wonderful time early on, but Don Armstrong did a lot with Don at Kentucky Summer Dance School.
Yes.
And made the connection really through him primarily, and then met Lou and Enid from there, and quite a number of other folks.
I've already interviewed Gib and Enid and Don Armstrong there on that Square Dance Foundation of New England's webpage, yes.
Well, I look forward to spending more time there.
Yes.
Don was just a gracious man. In fact, we were working on family genealogy in Germany in 1983 and had found out that he was calling up in Hanover. In fact, he'd contacted me. We'd discussed our trips. And anyway, we went up there to watch him call in Germany and danced the contras and squares up there in Hanover, and stayed overnight with dancers in Hanover up there. So he was a grand fellow, that's for sure.
He had a unique way of knowing exactly the right words to get people to do what he wanted them to do when he taught. Yeah. I interviewed him quite some time ago. We had a close relationship because my parents worked with him after they moved to Florida when he was in Newport Richey. And in fact, my mother played piano for him a few times down there.
Oh, but, really?
Yeah. It's a small world, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. Now, didn't he play drums?
Richey. And, in fact, my mother played piano for him a few times down there.
Oh,
but,
really?
Yeah. It's a small world, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. Now, didn't he play drums?
Yes.
Drums in one of his bands?
Yes.
Yeah.
And occasionally he would have to call and play drums at the same time. And I had to do the same thing back years ago.
Were you playing drums?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's interesting we're talking about that, because when I, for instance, these 1,000 eighth graders that I mentioned earlier, I play fiddle and call at the same time for those kind of events. And I always think back to Tony Parks watching him play the piano and call and
yes.
And there's not many people that do that. I'm so if you were playing drums and calling, well, you know, Albert Race, interesting to mention this, Albert Race was the caller at the first dance where Henry Ford met his wife Clara, and he was playing the dulcimer.
Huh.
Played the dulcimer and called the dances. So.
And that's tough.
Yeah. Yeah. Don was such a grand person. I really enjoyed him. Great teacher too. I mean, he led a lot of leadership workshops and really a very fine teacher.
Right. Don Armstrong's drum set is in the attic, I think, at the Lloyd Shaw Dance Archives, which is only 4 blocks from where I'm calling from.
Oh, is that right? Now, University of New Hampshire?
I'm sorry?
Is that University of New Hampshire?
No, here in Albuquerque.
Oh, in Albuquerque. Okay, good. Yes.
Yes. Well, tell us more about this Dance Through History program.
As part of the classes that Bert Schwartz did for the Detroit Country Dance Society, he always had an assistant, and over the years I was one of the assistants, and his programs, I'm remembering, were 6 weeks long, maybe eight. But in any case, he basically took the class through English country dance and squares and clogging and then modern contras. And that he had used in his instructions, the theme for this Dance Through History came from that. And because I've been calling English country dance as well, and historical, you know, cotillions and quadrilles and then later squares, I started this concept with one of the local schools, a school called Horning Elementary over here in Brighton, and it was a 3-day program. So we did 1700s the first day, 1800s the second day, and 1900s the third day.
Oh, that's interesting.
And picked things that would be interesting to fifth graders. That's where I started, was with fifth graders, and did a dance called Liberty, which was a three-pair dance, and And the approach for the fifth graders in particular was find a partner of your choice. It did not try to match up boy with girl at all. Just let them find a partner of their choice. And found dances that were fun for them to do and also helped steer away from the, if you'll pardon the expression, the cootie syndrome.
Yes.
Where the boys on occasion have a tough time touching the girls and the girls touching the boys.
Right.
So these dances help steer away from that problem. And so the 1700s dances are typically the long way sets, three pairs or four pairs or six pairs. And then the next day, and these are typically 50 minutes to 60 minutes long, and I'll do typically between two and four classes a day. And then the next day is 1800s, and that typically is are dances like the March Cotillion, which is an 1841 Hustis and Kraft dance, the quadrilles of the day, the publication of Elias Howe's 1,000 Jigs, Reels, Hornpipes, Clog Dances, and Contra Dances, and I might have missed a word, but the dances he chronicled in that book. So a lot of things from the 1800s, and use that with the kids as well, things that were interesting, in particular quadrilles. The second day is focuses on, you know, square formation, a cotillion, or an old cotillion from the 1700s that had been popular in the 1800s, and then quadrilles. And then the third day, the third day is a combination of modern squares, such as Old Granddad out of the Good Morning Book, or other squares like it, and also contra dances from, you know, the 1900s, and also disco dancing, which the kids get a big kick out of. And so that's the 1900s. And again, fifth graders in some schools, third, fourth, and fifth graders in other schools. Some schools, six, and in some schools, eighth grade or high school.
Well, you also mentioned acoustic dance parties that you do for teens. I don't understand quite what that is.
In this area, Bob, and I'm not sure what the extent of this is in the Albuquerque area or even on the East Coast, but the homeschool movement has been very prevalent here in Michigan. And some years ago, one of the homeschool groups in Madison Heights got a hold of us, and they had been members of one of the fife and drum corps groups in the area, and the kids had our dances for them as part of their graduation activities or their October Halloween activities. And those kids that were in the fife and drum corps belonged to one of the home schools, and so they had us come in and put on a dance with acoustic music, as we called it. We didn't call it old-fashioned music or old-time music. We called it acoustic music, which seemed to have more of a draw for the kids. And I'm talking, you know, 10-year-old to 18-year-old kids. And so when we used the words acoustic music and contra dancing, we've had and continue to have huge crowds of kids. Madison Heights, Assumption Grotto down in Detroit, up in Rochester, over in the Heartland area. But these dances, Bob, are 220, 240 kids, and on occasion they could, half of them would have to sit out because the place wasn't big enough.
Right.
And they didn't have a problem with that. They would sit out and have a pop or a juice or something like
yes.
that. And then they'd swap, and there'd be a different group on the floor. But these kids, I mean, talk about the energy. It's just a treat to be leading these kids, the homeschool groups in the area. And, again, some huge ones. One of the Lutheran churches in Troy has a homeschool Association at the Faith Lutheran Church, that's the name of it. And huge groups of kids and parents. I don't want to exclude the parents. The parents come too, but it's...
Yeah, I wanted to ask you that, yes.
Yeah. Generally, it's the kids. I'm going to say it's like 70-30. 70% kids and 30% parents that are dancing. But it's definitely a younger focus, and everybody's having a good time together. That's the key.
Yes. Well, but the actual music used was what, actually old-time?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, it was fiddle, dulcimer, guitar, typically, or keyboard, later years.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, same musician, same music. We just called it something different because it had more appeal to the younger folks.
I'll be darned. That's interesting. Well, that describes your present-day programs pretty much. Just in passing, I made a note to myself. Modern Western square dancing has been on the decline for some time. I was just wondering, are your programs holding their own, or are you advancing or diminishing or what?
That's a very interesting question. We've been seeing the number of adult dancers diminishing from a combination of things, you know, joint issues and people that have had many, many years of dancing, and it was time to, you know, have another hobby that was less stressful, you know, on the physical part of people. So we've seen the adult numbers diminish, and the interesting dilemma is how long do you keep bands in place and callers in place supporting, you know, a Grange dance or a town hall dance or a community dance where the numbers that used to be, you know, in 160, 200 range have come down to the 60, 40, 80 range. And we were all fretting about that. Until this homeschool opportunity came along, and it's interesting and I see it as, and I'm not unique, I'm sure, in saying this, although I haven't heard it before, but this grandparent grandchild I don't know if you call it a syndrome or what, but in any case, it's interesting how it tends to skip generations, where most of the people who continue to dance as they're able, you know, they're in their 50s and 60s, and these kids that have come along that are eager to dance now are, you know, 10 to 18. So it seemed to skip a generation, not entirely, but
yes,
it's been interesting to see that. And that's been part of the issue, I think, with the diminishing numbers, is typically... And this is certainly not a broad statement, but well, I guess I'm not a narrow statement, but a broad statement is there are lots of kids of dancers that are dancing, but it appears that the real numbers are coming into the grandkids that are dancing. So yes, our numbers are down, and we've had dances, you know, that were staples for a long time, reduced in size and two groups combine, so that's just, I think, a natural evolution of the generations.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, yeah. Well, but you feel your homeschool program is definitely on the upswing, then.
It very much so, much so, yeah.
Well, maybe we should look into that more in other places. I don't hear other people talking about that very much around the country, but, well...
Yeah. It's interesting that there's, and recently I sat down and just jotted down this descendants chart where one homeschool group was dancing, and that group got so large that some of the people in the group said, well, why don't we start another dance over here? So we started another dance over here, so now there's two going, and that got so large that the group said, well, you know, let's do it twice a year rather than once a year. And
yeah.
So, it's an interesting view of how it's
right. Well,
progressed.
What other weekend kind of things have you done, like out of your own area? I noticed, for example, that you had performed over in Denmark and Belgium on occasion.
Through John Ramsey, the connections that the Rhea Christmas School has had for years with the Danish heritage, he connected us with a group in Tisted, Denmark, up in the Jutland, that was interestingly very much like the Paint Creek Folklore Society and the old Michigan Roughwater String Band. And it was areas called two Folkdancer Schlau and two Spielmann Schlau. And we started an exchange of folk music and dance activities between Denmark and Michigan and Kentucky. And in fact, they came here, 20 some of them came here in 84, and 20 some of us went there in 85, and then we repeated it in 87 and 89. But that was a connection for us into Denmark, and we got to dance, you know, a lot of Danish dances. But we met Margot Gunzenhauser over there, and with that connection between the two Spielmann Schlau group and Margot, dance school that was started in Schoon, we were invited to come over there and call three or four times in Denmark between Copenhagen and up into the Jutland. And then again through Christmas school, we met Philippe Callens, and Philippe invited us to come over and lead dancing in Belgium. So we did that and thoroughly enjoyed that, and in particular saw the value of not being so reliant on the language, but able to show a movement and people learn in that fashion.
Yes.
And then from there, of course, in Germany, having seen Don and a fellow by the name of Fischli lead dancing up there, that opened the door for us again for Denmark, and we were up into Sweden, up into Norway, Belgium. I think those are the countries that we've been to over there teaching and leading dances, typically for either a weekend event like in Osted, or for a week-long activity that included a circuit of dances, you know, across the Jutland and down into Copenhagen.
Well, that's interesting.
Great experience.
Yeah. Did you get over into New England at all?
Yes. Judy and I were invited to come over to the Ralph Page Legacy Weekend at Durham there at the campus.
Yes.
And we thoroughly enjoyed that. Met some of our heroes, you know, that we've been in communication with, either through letters or phone calls, and gathered there at that place with, you know, Ted Sinella and Gene and Bob McQuillan, and certainly when we'd met Dudley years earlier, he had come to East Lansing to lead a workshop, as we had a real keen interest in more of the things that Dudley was doing. And one of our band members had been connected with Dudley. Bob Hubbock is one of our band members, and he and Dudley had connected, and Bob would pop out to Dudley's backyard, and they would play a number of tunes together, and Bob would go to their dances, play dulcimer at their dances, a Michigan-style dulcimer. And,
right.
And, in fact, we had Dudley come in for the last dance that we had at Lovett Hall in 2005.
I didn't realize that.
Him and we invited him and Jacqueline to come in, and he came in and joined us, called a dance, Lady of the Lake, and played. Him and Jackie played with us at the last dance. We had 537 people at the last dance.
right.
At Lovett Hall, a huge crowd.
Right. Well, this is a good lead-in to talk more about Henry Ford and the Henry Ford Museum and the Lovett Hall and so forth. I see we're almost down to the end of this tape, so why don't I take a second and turn the tape over, so just hold on a minute.
Certainly.
Okay, we're back, turned the tape over, and we're just about to start talking about the Henry Ford Museum, and especially about the fabulous Lovett Hall in Durban Village in Michigan. Perhaps before we get to Lovett Hall, do you want to recount how Lovett Hall came into existence through Henry Ford?
Yes. Henry had built his home in Dearborn called Fairlane, and that home included a dance, I would call it a dance area, on the north end of the house, and he was reminiscing a bit about how he and Clara had met and was having dances there. He also built a field room down in the basement, and he was having people over, just more of a social time together, and they started remembering these dances that they'd all been to, and then Henry said, well, you know, we ought to think about reviving that, and he was a man of his word. He started recounting some of the dances, and he was at that point connected to Sudbury, Massachusetts, the Wayside Inn, and he, as part of the things he was doing, sought out Benjamin Lovett, who had been recommended to him as, you know, one of the dance masters of the area. And so he connected with Benjamin Lovett and had brought him back to Dearborn to lead some dancing for his friends in the Dearborn area. And after that introduction to Dearborn, Henry asked him to come and lead some activities associated primarily with dance, to teach them some of the old steps they used to do, but also some of the newer things that were being taught. And the long and the short of it, he asked Benjamin to stay, and he did, and he started to begin with dances in the engineering laboratory, which Ford had built, which sits right next to the present-day Greenfield Village. But the Ford Engineering Lab was there, and there are photos of Benjamin Lovett calling there. And as part of this revival, he pulled together an orchestra. The early orchestra had cymbalum, which is a Romanian kind of an instrument that he used for backup, and certainly the violin, dulcimer, played by Edmund Baxter, and sousaphone. Henry's uncles played in the Dearborn instrument that he used for backup, and certainly the violin, dulcimer, played by Edmund Baxter, and sousaphone. Henry's uncles played in the Dearborn Town Orchestra, and they played on the bandwagons, brass music on the bandwagon. So, and Henry was fascinated with the sousaphone, so that was part of the band, and what a sound, I mean, unbelievable. So these dances were happening at the engineering lab, and shortly after those dances started up, Henry started engaging the schools in the area to come to the engineering lab to dance, but as well, he would, by then, he had quite a number of callers identified, and Benjamin Lovett was organizing these trips to these schools to take the old quadrilles, lancers, contra dances, couple dances, into the area schools. And then after they had spent time in the schools, they would invite the schools to come back and dance as kind of a graduation activity, if you will, at the engineering lab. And this is in the late 20s and into the early 30s, and it was met with such success that Henry wanted to build a recreation area as part of Henry Ford Museum Greenfield Village. And so he built this recreation area, and the recreation area included Lovett Hall. Now the hall is in a building that includes a swimming pool, a gymnasium, boys and girls dormitories, and the eating facility, cafeteria. So he wasn't focused just on dance. He saw dance as part of a whole program of recreation. And he had that built just shortly after he did the Ford buildings down at Martha Berry College. And that building was dedicated in October of 1937. And the second floor, is, as you know, Bob, is teak on springs, three chandeliers, a band shell that is concrete with the plastered face. Just a gorgeous dance hall. I mean, and an interesting little fact that I dug out about the hall is that the floor is crowned a half inch in the middle. So that little bit of, I think the hall is like 80 by 180 or something like that. I might be off, but that big hall is crowned a half inch high in the middle. And that's just enough to keep people from bunching up in the middle and keeps people, moving to the outside. I thought that was a great engineering.
I'd never heard that.
Point of that hall. Yeah.
Well, so then were they running regular dances there, or were?
They were running classes there. Again, they were bringing students in, and Benjamin and the callers were leading classes there. And then they used that for these, I call them graduation exercises, but
yes.
They weren't just, a June graduation. If they were running a program in one of the schools at the completion of that 6-week program or 10-week program, they'd have the kids come in and dance in Lovett Hall. And they might have quite a number of schools, so they would fill up the hall with multiple schools dancing, and so there was a lot of camaraderie amongst the kids that were dancing there. Of course, the hall was dedicated to Benjamin Lovett, and that was dedicated by Edsel Ford, Henry's son. And what's interesting about this notion of getting the schools involved, over the years I've interviewed a lot of the students of Benjamin Lovett, and they all come back with the same story of how important it was to them, throughout their life, these things that he taught them. I get a big thrill out of these stories that come along about how important dancing was.
Did you have those recorded anywhere?
Yes. One fellow in particular lives up in... I got to think for a second. Lexington, Michigan, and I've got a tape of his interview. His last name was Raymond. And who else did I pick up on? Bruce Simpson was another student of Benjamin Lovett's, who later became one of the head top fellows in the engineering department for Henry Ford, and who is still alive. I just was with him about 6 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And similar stories about the etiquette side of things, as well as the dance, and how much they learned about movement, and the word grace wasn't used much, light on your feet.
Yeah, decorum.
Decorum, there you go.
Right. Yes. Well, I understand he was a stickler for that, right?
Yeah, there were things that he pretty much
yes
made sure were part of the
did
way people conducted themselves.
When he built that, did it have the Lovett name from its inception?
It had the Lovett name from the inception of the hall. When they dedicated the hall, it was dedicated as Lovett Hall.
I see.
Yeah, October 1937.
Uh-huh. Well, I understand you had a series of dances there for, what, 23 years?
Yes, we did. We were very fortunate and honored to be a part of that tradition there. And started in October of 1981, and the village just wanted to do a pilot to see if there would be enough interest, in the American Contra Dancing series. And so we did 3 months, and it was well received, and we kept going. So we were there every year from October through May. Sometimes the year extended to June, but October through May for a little over 23 years. Yeah. Great opportunity. Yeah, great music. And what was fun about it is we'd bring in other things to show. We're fortunate in Ann Arbor is a group called the Cobblestone Farm Country Dancers, and they were vintage dancers. And they were doing the old quadrilles. David Park Williams, who was connected to Dudley way back, and the Farm and Wilderness Group, he lived in Ann Arbor, so they started up this vintage group. So we'd have them in once in a while to do, one of the old Lancers or one of the old quadrilles, and also some of the vintage dancers, like Pleasant Moments Vintage Dancing, certainly the different callers who would come to visit, like Gibb. Gibb called at Lovett Hall, Gibb Gilbert, and
yes.
Ted Sinella.
Well, that's great. Well,
and it's interesting to see the program. I've got all the programs across those 23 years. It's really interesting to see the evolution across those years in the programs, where to start with it was primarily chorus, jig, and Petronella, and the old duple proper Contras, and of course, by the time the later years rolled around, we would do Petronella once in a while, and of course, jig once in a while, but they were primarily modern Contra dances.
Well, that's really great. Then I understand the. I started first hearing about Glenn Morningstar when they were talking about closing Lovett Hall to the public, and I think you had a final dance there in 2005, was it?
Yes. It was February of 2005, and we had 537 people there, and we over the years, we used to put these Ford Reconstruction Orchestras together. In fact, we did one for the 50th anniversary of the hall in 1987, and we did it again in 97. So for that last dance, we had a good friend of ours, Merle Raber, on sousaphone, and of course, Ralph Water String Band, and Dudley and Jacqueline, and Judy Raber, who was the daughter of one of our Michigan treasures, Les Raber, who was a fiddler, and so we really did it upright. That last dance, we had a whole band shell full of great musicians, and we're having a great time to make sure we honored the hall and honored the dancers that supported us for all those years.
Right. Well, then I believe that Dave Taylor and my brother Al got together and put on what they call it a cotillion or something, and was made up mostly of modern Western dancers, but it was in full costume. And did you happen to get to that dance?
We did not. And in fact, it was interestingly enough, one of those was just a month before we started the series. I had jotted down. I'm thinking it was September 1981. I know what it was. It was a September 1981 issue of Northern Junket. That's what I'm thinking of, because I know it was September of 1980 was one of the times that they were there, because I went into the archives at the museum once I found out about that, and got the program. I think it was a September 1980 program. and looked through the program to see what kind of dances were being done, and also the fact that they had, as a gift to the people that participated, given them one of the old Henry Ford Orchestra 78s.
Huh.
And so I was very interested in that. So in my archives here, I've got the program from your brother and Dave Taylor's gathering there. I think it's September 1980. I might be off by a year.
Huh. I didn't think it was that far back.
Yeah.
I'll be darned. Well, my mind is slowly disappearing too, you know.
Well, mine, yeah, I don't trust mine anymore, that's right. For sure. I thank God for my archives, you know.
Yes, true. Well, all right, well, you certainly put a different light on Henry Ford Museum story. The Henry Ford Museum is a separate building, of course, or
yes,
is part of Deerfield Village, right?
Yeah. For years they called it Henry Ford Museum and Greenfield Village, and so the museum itself, you know, contained all these artifacts from across the generations, the mechanization, and then the village includes, you know, the Firestone Farm and the Cotswold Cottage and buildings like that, and then that includes the recreation building, the education building, and Lovett Hall. So actually their neighbors, the museum is just across the little roadway from Lovett Hall. So Lovett Hall really sits between the museum and the village.
I see.
More closely associated with the village, but
yeah.
But
is there much activity at Lovett Hall these days?
I called a dance there Memorial Day weekend. They have a Civil War Remembrances weekend every year, and they have Civil War reenactors come in, a huge crowd, and they do a wonderful job. And then on Saturday night, they have a grand military ball in Lovett Hall. And so I called there on Saturday night of Memorial Day weekend. Huge crowd filled the place, probably, you know, 200, 220, 240, something like that.
Yeah.
And so I called dances from, you know, the 1800s, 1860s period for them. So the dancing that's done there is generally just that. They just have a special dance once or twice a year now. And certainly as the next generation comes along, I'm hopeful that the dancing will resume there while I'm still alive. And
right.
What's so nice is that we've got some very fine up-and-coming callers in Michigan that, you know, once that generation gets through college,
right,
that the likes of Danica Murray and some other young callers like that that are in the area could step forward and make sure dancing starts up there again when the kids are ready.
Are there photographic records of some of these events?
Yes, there are. Certainly like the 50th anniversary of the hall, I've got a sizable photographic record of that. And our dances at Lovett Hall, there's both video and photograph records.
Yes.
Of those. Quite an extensive library, really, from VHS to 8mm. So we keep those here, that's for sure.
Right.
The research center there, the Benson Ford Research Center there, has got a real nice archive of the old Ford Orchestra with photos and the Lovett Hall photos, and certainly the collection of the newsletters that were constructed there when it was called the Edison Institute. They were called the Dearborn Heralds, and I've got that collection minus one of the books in the collection, and there's tons of pictures of Lovett Hall and kids dancing and the Ford Orchestra and Benjamin Lovett calling and in those books. So there's quite a good collection.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I wanted to be sure to ask you, too, after Benjamin Lovett, the next one that was Dick Moore?
Yes, Dick called her quite regularly after Lovett left.
Did he just leave the building, or he didn't pass away then, did he?
Benjamin Lovett?
Yeah.
Oh, no, him and his wife moved back to Massachusetts.
Oh, did they? I see. Okay.
Yeah, it was after Edsel died. The activities really started to diminish there, and I'm remembering that Lovett moved back to the Sudbury area. I'm going to say it was like 45 or thereabouts. I might be off by a year or two. It was before Henry passed. Henry passed in 47.
Okay.
So between when Edsel passed and Henry passed is when he went back. And there's the book by Eva Twork, I'm remembering, has a number of accounts of Benjamin and his wife being at the dances.
Yes.
In Massachusetts, and you know, just taking more of a "I'm here to enjoy it" kind of a role, not a leadership role, but just more of a enjoying the.
Okay, and then Dick Moore took over then.
Yeah, I'm remembering it was Dick that was next. I know Dick and Al Hards. I've got a number of photos of them calling. At Lovett, and of course Dick was leading dances all around the Dearborn area. I'm going to say it's 100 some dance programs of his, again from the late 40s. In fact, I was just looking for, I think I found it here, dance cards from the Dearborn Country Club, 1948 through 57, Maples Early American Dancing Group, 48 through 53, Dearborn Recreation Department, 1951 through 56. So he was calling, well, in January 1948, so that was just after Henry
yes.
had passed. So he was calling there, and I'm remembering that Eva Twork's book does a better job of, listing this passage of the baton, if you will.
Right.
To Dick Moore and to Al Hards. And there was one other caller, too, Cipriani. One of the band members started calling as well. I just don't remember who it was.
I didn't realize that, yeah. Well, I think we pretty well covered this, Glenn, unless you can think of anything else you'd like to add.
Well, I guess the only thing I would add is it's becoming apparent how important dancing is to communities, and we were seeing it obviously in what we were doing in Dearborn, but when we started doing more of these homeschool groups, the ability of the kids to get together and really build their social skills, their health skills, I mean all of these things associated with really any kind of dance, but I think the social side of squares and contras is a pretty important part of I'm going to say the community where it's done, and I think it really is a positive part of the growth of any community and the growth of the people within it. So I just wanted to mention that these guys that like Benjamin Lovett and Ralph Page and Lloyd Shaw, they knew what they were doing and the value of what they were doing, and sometimes I think that it's missed. Even though it's in books, how important deportment and decorum and all of these things are in building good character and building healthy citizens. So.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I appreciate your making that comment, too. So, why don't we call her today, and if we think of anything else, I can always give you a call back, but... I'll be transcribing this and getting it posted on the webpage for the Square Dance Foundation of New England sometime. It'll take me a little while to get through it because I'm not a fast typer. But so why don't we call it a day? And
well, thank you, Bob. I appreciate it. And I'm thrilled at your project and what it's doing to capture these stories and this evolution that we've seen across all these years.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's a great idea and a great project.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay. So, thank you again, Mr. Glenn Morningstar from Michigan.
Thank you, Bob Brundage.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.